KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Senator Chris Van Hollen meets the man illegally deported to El Salvador as an appeals court says the administration is asserting a right to stash people in foreign prisons without due process. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Europe is cutting interest rates, and President Trump is pressuring the Federal Reserve to do the same thing here. I'm Leila Faldick.
And I'm Martinez. Fed Chair Jerome Powell says he can't be fired. What protects him from political pressure? Also, the Trump administration stops a multi-billion dollar wind project that was already underway, and Cheech and Chong on what could be their last movie together. It's Friday, April 18th, the publication date in 1938 of Action Comics number one, the debut of a certain alien refugee destined to be Superman. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A federal appeals court has issued the latest ruling against the Trump administration's handling of an immigrant illegally deported to El Salvador. The U.S. Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals says the Trump administration is, quote, asserting a right to stash away residents of this country in foreign prisons without the semblance of due process. This case has already been to the U.S. Supreme Court, but it could return if the Trump administration appeals. The Supreme Court says it will hear expedited arguments next month on the issue of birthright citizenship. The 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution says that all persons born or naturalized in the U.S. are American citizens. The matter has been settled law for more than a century. But NPR's Nina Totenberg says President Trump disagrees.
Trump, however, has long argued that there is no such thing as automatic citizenship, at least not for babies born in the United States if their parents were not born here. So, on his first day in office, he issued an executive order banning birthright citizenship, which was promptly challenged in court by a bunch of states.
NPR's Nina Totenberg reporting. Every year, the U.S. State Department releases human rights reports on every country around the world. NPR's Graham Smith tells us that this year there are major changes coming in these reports.
Internal State Department documents reviewed by NPR show the Trump administration is dropping multiple categories of human rights abuses from its annual country reports. No longer will the U.S. call out governments for violations against the freedom to privacy, the right to free and fair elections, or the right to peacefully assemble. More than 20 kinds of violations are being stripped out. According to these documents, to comply with recently issued executive orders from the White House, among them violence against minorities and disabled people and serious government corruption. Human rights defenders tell NPR they're concerned the U.S. is abandoning its post as a supporter of personal freedoms and that this will send the wrong message to authoritarian governments. Graham Smith, NPR News.
A vigil will be held today on the Florida State University campus in Tallahassee for the victims of yesterday's mass shooting. NPR's Greg Allen reports the 20-year-old suspect arrested by police is the son of a sheriff's deputy.
Police say Phoenix Eichner used his mother's handgun to shoot eight people, killing two. Leon County Sheriff said he'd been a member of the department's youth advisory board and had gone through extensive training with the department. The shootings occurred near Florida State University's Student Union Building. Students locked themselves in basements and bathrooms while they heard gunshots being fired outside. Eichner didn't surrender when confronted by police and was shot and wounded before being arrested. Classes at FSU are canceled today as are home athletic events through the weekend. Greg Allen, NPR News.
This is NPR. Officials in Puerto Rico say they've restored power to nearly 99% of their customers. The entire island lost power Wednesday. Initial reports suggest part of the problem was heavy vegetation blocking a major transmission line. Puerto Ricans are worried as summer approaches, more people use air conditioning, putting heavy demand on the power grid. Chinese goods may soon become harder to find in the United States. NPR's John Ruwich reports exporters at a massive trade fair in China say shipments to the U.S. are grinding to a halt in response to President Trump's sky-high tariffs.
At the Canton Fair in southern China, tens of thousands of Chinese companies display products, and customers from around the world come to wheel and deal. But if you ask about trade with the U.S., it's grim.
Monica Liang is a sales manager at a company that makes juicers and blenders. She says everyone is in wait-and-see mode. Customers from the U.S. have halted orders, she says, and products are piling up in warehouses. Some here expressed optimism that China and the U.S. would strike a deal and avert disaster. But until then, few seem to be selling goods across the Pacific. And many say they're looking for new markets altogether. John Ruich, NPR News, Guangzhou, China.
The Defense Department says that the U.S. attacked a port in Yemen. U.S. Central Command says the U.S. targeted fuel imports that are used to support Houthi rebels instead of Yemeni citizens. The Houthis say the U.S. attack has killed at least 58 people and wounded more than 100 others. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. Coming up, we'll speak with a financial historian about how President Trump may be threatening the independence of the Federal Reserve.
First, though, Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen held a face-to-face meeting with Kilmer Abrego Garcia yesterday.
He's the Salvadoran citizen who lived in Maryland for about 15 years before the administration illegally deported him last month. Now, he's being held in a notorious mega prison in El Salvador, where the administration is sending people deported from the U.S. Now, the White House insists he will not be returning to the U.S. despite a federal judge's order to facilitate his return.
Joining us with the latest is NPR's Ryland Barton. Good morning, Ryland.
Hi, Leila.
Okay, so Senator Van Hollen says Salvadoran officials initially refused to let him meet with Abrego Garcia, and then we see a meeting happened. What changed?
Yeah, so we know very little about how exactly the meeting happened, but in an interview yesterday on All Things Considered, Van Hollen said soldiers had initially prevented him from reaching the prison.
I was stopped by soldiers about 3 kilometers out, who said they'd been ordered not to allow me to go see him. My mission today was simply to see how his health is, what his condition is.
So later in the day, the president of El Salvador, Nayib Bukele, tweeted that Van Hollen had met with Abrego Garcia and said that since Abrego Garcia had been confirmed healthy, he gets the honor of staying in El Salvador's custody. The senator then tweeted out a picture of the two of them sitting at a table and said he had called Abrego Garcia's wife to pass along a message of love. In a statement, White House spokesman Kush Desai said the meeting showed Democrats were prioritizing the welfare of what he called an illegal alien MS-13 terrorist. The Trump administration has repeatedly said Abrego Garcia is a member of MS-13, which is a transnational gang. But Abrego Garcia's lawyers dispute that, pointing to the fact that he doesn't even have a criminal record in the U.S.
Now, there was yet another court ruling against the Trump administration's handling of Abrego Garcia yesterday. What did it say?
Yeah, so the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals tore into the administration, saying they are, quote, asserting a right to stash away residents of this country in foreign prisons without the semblance of due process. Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson, who was appointed by President Reagan, headed up that three-judge panel. He noted that the Justice Department had already admitted it deported Brego Garcia mistakenly and asked, quote, why then should it not make what was wrong right? Earlier this week, a judge had ruled Abrego Garcia's lawyers should be able to question administration officials, but the Department of Justice argues that that was untenable and said the government had no powers to return Abrego Garcia. But with this latest ruling, they have lost that argument, so now officials must explain what they're doing, if anything, to bring him back, or they could appeal again, this time to the Supreme Court.
And what did the court say about the administration's refusal to comply with these orders?
Yeah, so Judge Wilkinson said this is a slippery slope. In his order, he imagined a future in which there would be no assurances that the executive branch would not deport American citizens or train its powers on political enemies. He said we're in a moment where the executive and judicial branches are close to grinding irrevocably against one another in a conflict that promises to diminish both. But he also said there is an opportunity here, saying, quote, we yet cling to the hope that it is not naive to believe our good brethren in the executive branch perceive the rule of law as vital to the American ethos. This ruling follows a decision from U.S. District Judge James Boasberg earlier this week, where he said he might hold Trump officials in contempt for disregarding his order to stop sending deportees to that same Salvadoran prison.
That's NPR's Ryland Barton. Thank you, Ryland.
Thank you.
President Trump is trying to pressure the Federal Reserve to lower interest rates, which it's reluctant to do because of tariffs. And after Fed Chair Jerome Powell warned that Trump's tariff policies could make it harder to limit inflation, the president posted on social media yesterday that Powell's termination, quote, cannot come fast enough. To talk this through, we're joined by Peter Conti Brown. He's a financial historian and associate professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Peter, welcome to the program. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So does the president have the legal authority to fire Powell before his term expires in May of next year?
You know, last time we had almost exactly this conversation in the first Trump administration, the answer was much clearer that the president did not. But in the last few months in the second Trump administration, the president has made an assault on the independence of administrative agencies a keystone of his legal strategy. And those very questions, which are currently being litigated, could determine the answer to that question. It's much more uncertain today than it was in, say, 2018.
What makes it more uncertain? I mean, Trump has fired, as you point out, members of independent agencies since taking office, and the Supreme Court sided with him in a case related to two of those firings earlier this month. Is that what is making this moment uncertain?
That's the big part of it. The Supreme Court and the Trump administration itself have said, kind of hinted, that the Fed might be different. But as I sit here today as both a historian and as a legal scholar, I read the statutes and they have exactly, nearly word for word, the same protections at the Federal Trade Commission, for example, as the Federal Reserve. So if those protections go away because the Supreme Court writes them away, then the independence of the Federal Reserve is much more fragile than it was before.
Why is the Fed's independence important? And is Trump's attempt to pressure its actions unique to a president?
The independence of the Federal Reserve stands for the idea that all politicians are going to want to goose the economy in the short term because that makes their voters and their constituents happy. And that's a bipartisan enthusiasm. In that sense, President Trump is not unique. Nearly every president has wanted the Fed to be more accommodating to their policies. But we don't want a short-term sugar rush of stimulus in the economy. And so Congress designed the central bank to have its eye on the long-term ball. We want stability. We want growth without inflation. And so the independence of the Federal Reserve is to create that kind of scenario. What's unique about President Trump is his wide assertions to delegitimize that very independence. And that's the thing, as I sit here today, that I fear the most.
You say you fear that. What happens if it comes to fruition?
If people don't trust the Federal Reserve to keep their eye on that long-term ball, if they believe President Trump that it's just political hacks, operating monetary policy and doing so incompetently, then their ability to plan, to trust in these institutions, to put their confidence in the economy for the future will upend everything about that we understand about economic growth and about where we're going as an economy.
Yesterday, Politico reported that Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has warned the White House that firing Powell could destabilize financial markets. Is he correct?
He's absolutely right. The destabilization we've seen in the bond markets, for example, in reaction to the tariff policy, would be like a child's soccer game compared to the World Cup of destabilization if we lose Fed independence. Fed independence is the bulwark of stability for the bond market, for our capital markets, for the U.S. dollar. If that goes away, well, we know this story. We've seen economies like this in Turkey and Lebanon and Venezuela and so many other places. The Fed's independence keeps us from that chaos.
I mean, you're describing economies that have failed, that have tanked. I mean, is that possible in the U.S.?
That is not something that I would have said yes to even many months ago, but I would say that it is possible today, yes.
Trump allies argue that the president should have more authority over independent agencies. They exist under the executive branch. What are your thoughts on that argument?
I think the idea of independence is a bit of a red herring. The Federal Reserve is not independent. It's insulated. The president has enormous power to influence the direction of the Fed. And that comes when Jay Powell's term ends 1 year from now and he gets to select the next Fed chair. But it shouldn't come before.
Peter Conte Brown is a financial historian at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio says the U.S. will walk away from efforts to broker a ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine if progress isn't made within days. Rubio spoke a day after a new peace push in Paris, organized by French President Emmanuel Macron, that for the first time included European allies. Here's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley.
After 2 months of direct talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin went nowhere, the Trump administration seemed willing to give the European initiative a shot, sending its top three diplomats to Paris. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio and White House envoy Steve Witkoff and Keith Kellogg sat down with French President Emmanuel Macron and envoys from the U.K., Germany, and Ukraine. It was the highest level of transatlantic engagement on the conflict since February. Macron said the meeting had been productive and that talks would continue in London next week. But leaving Paris this morning, Rubio said things had to happen in a matter of days, not weeks.
If it's not possible, if we're so far apart that this is not going to happen, then I think the president's probably at a point where he's going to say, well, we're done.
That comes as no surprise to Ukraine expert Nicholas Tenzer, who says Europe has different priorities than those of the White House.
To find a deal with Putin, Russia, and then basically to turn to other matters, namely China, Asia, etc. And then he wants basically to get rid of this issue, even if it means a kind of full surrender to Putin.
He says for the Europeans, the defense of Ukraine and survival of the Ukrainian nation is a priority in itself and key to European security. Tenzer says whatever the U.S. decides, the Europeans will continue to arm and support Ukraine. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about Medgar and Merle Evers. Medgar was a civil rights leader from Mississippi who was assassinated in 1963 because of his work fighting for voting rights and desegregation. His wife Merle became a civil rights activist after his murder. We'll talk with Joy Ann Reed. Her book is Medgar and Merle. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Ooma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at Ooma.com/NPR. And from Total Wine & More, for discovering something new, like a Cabernet or single-barrel bourbon. Learn more at TotalWine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Available to adults 21 or older. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez.
Who is it?
It's me, Dave. Open up, man. I got the stuff.
In the 1970s, Cheech and Chong were the OGs of pot humor.
Dave?
Yeah, Dave, come on, man, open up, I think the cops
Dave's saw me. Not here!
No, man, I'm Dave, man.
Their albums hit the top 10. Their live shows sold out. Their movie screenings were jam-packed with fans, though I have no idea how they saw the screen through the haze. There's a new documentary about their partnership. It's called Cheech and Chong's Last Movie. Now, here's one thing I learned. Before he met Cheech, Tommy Chong was in a band signed to Motown Records.
I had a family-owned nightclub in Vancouver, Canada, and the house band. We never had a name, but we had a house band, and we had a great singer named Bobby Taylor. And Diana Ross and the Supremes came and heard Bobby sing. So she phoned Berry Gordy, and Berry Gordy literally flew the next day. He signed us. He loved us, signed us. I got fired from Motown.
They found out he was Chinese.
It was in that nightclub that Tommy Chong first met Cheech Marin in 1969. Cheech grew up in L.A., but went to Vancouver to learn pottery and to avoid getting drafted for the Vietnam War. The two started performing comedy together, then made their way to L.A. to hone their act. As they got bigger, they got to shoot their first film on a shoestring budget. Up in Smoke became a cult smash in 1978.
Like I smoked that Michoacan, man, Acapulco Gold, man. I even smoked that Tide Stick, you know?
Tide Stick?
Yeah, you know, that stuff is tied to a stick, you know?
Tide Stick.
So my mom would not let me watch your stuff.
That's a wise mom.
She was afraid. No, she was afraid that I would start smoking pot. But did you ever come up with, like, later on with people's like, I always wanted to see what you did, but I was always not allowed to see what you did.
All the time. We heard that story all the time. And it's always with the fathers that come in, blah, 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 yeah. You can't do this. And they became the biggest fans. It was never the moms. It was always the dads.
Did you guys ever think, like, this association with marijuana, because at the time it's illegal taboo, did you ever think that that eventually might be something that would harm you at some point?
No, we never really thought about it, because we were reflecting the culture that was around us at the time. And we did a survey of all the material we did, at both on stage and on records, and it was only 5% of anything we did. Hmm. But it was the biggest image that came up in everybody's mind as soon as they first heard about us or saw us.
But even Cheech, you came to a point where you wanted to do something not related to marijuana, right?
Yeah. Then we were getting pegged, oh, they're just about marijuana and blah, 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 blah.
Well, that was our secret sauce with the studios. And so we got a movie called the Corsican Brothers. Cheech and I decided that no pot in this one. You know, this is our chance.
Because they hadn't invented pot.
They hadn't invented pot.
And so I directed it and wrote it. And the studio, they weren't too happy. The suit that was assigned to the movie, she kept trying to get us to put pot in the movie.
Well, your films, like in the video store, like when they actually had the videotapes, right? It was almost like your films, you know, in the bookstore where you have like the X-rated magazines. Yeah, it's Oh, you always felt like you're kind of looking around to see who's watching you grab Up in Smoke or grab next movie. It almost felt like I had to like grab it and stick it in my coat and walk.
That was like an advertising dream. Hmm. You know, if you got something that's taboo, it's called like negative publicity. Up in Smoke kind of was like starting that. In fact, the advertising line was, don't go straight to this movie.
Cheech and Chong's Up in Smoke. Don't go straight to see this movie.
I was watching the documentary. There was a point in it where, and this is where you guys need to help me, like what's real and what isn't, where it was a little uncomfortable when you guys were talking about the films that you were in and who directed.
On the other movies, I would write. Cheech would go on vacation, Howard would make the deal, and then we'd come in and shoot. But this time, Cheech wanted to be involved in everything. And he didn't want me to direct. Tom Alvison was the editor. I said, okay, Tom, you direct. You'll go down as a director. I don't care. But I'll actually be the director.
So, Tommy, you directed the films.
Wrote
and directed them.
And directed.
Wrote the films.
But you didn't get Cheech the director credit.
I didn't want director credit.
We both directed. See, back in the day, there was rules, unwritten rules. You know, you don't have two directors until the Coen brothers came in, you know. And it's all about the old way of doing the money. You see, because if you're a director, you're getting paid.
So if we were to go back in time to kind of, you know, recredit the films, would it be directed by Cheech and Chong?
Yeah.
Yeah, probably would be.
Yeah.
But, yeah. I mean, Cheech, did you ever get annoyed that...
Not at that point. It's just, you know, when I wanted to kind of go in a slightly different direction or do something, and then that's where the division came.
Because in the documentary, it seemed like that was a tense moment between you two.
Well, you always were the director. It wasn't
and
like
you got to earn it. You can't just say, oh, because I was there with the other guy that directed, I should be a director.
See, that's a lie.
That's a lie?
Yeah, well, of course it's a lie. I directed just as much as you did in the movies.
Oh, it is a tense moment.
It's still a tense moment.
Well, we broke up after that. Okay, yeah. You go your way, I'll go mine, and that was it. And we were broken up for 20 years.
Yeah.
And then we came back together for another 20 years, it seemed like. We didn't make movies or make records, but we were on the road.
Yeah. Now, you're publicizing the film Cheech and Chong's last movie. I mean, should we take that literally? Is this the last time we're going to see Cheech and Chong together?
Yeah, you never know. I mean, really, you never know. If something comes up and we like it, you might see a Cheech and Chong's last movie.
Last movie?
Yeah.
That's Cheech Marin and Tommy Chong. They're the subjects of the new documentary, Cheech and Chong's Last Movie. It's receiving a limited release on, of course, you guessed it, 420. Gentlemen, thank you for coming in.
Our pleasure.
Are we on?
Come on, let's book it high. Up in Smoke. That's where I want to be.
This is NPR News.
A new podcast uses folktales to explore the richness of Sudan's culture and history at a time when the country is mired in a devastating civil war.
When you hear the music, read the literature, taste the food of a people, you come closer to them.
I'm Elsa Chang, Folktales from Sudan, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. A suspect is in custody after a mass shooting at Florida State University in Tallahassee yesterday. Officials say two people were killed and six others were wounded. They say the 20-year-old suspect is a student there and the son of a sheriff's deputy. Student Andre Perez says his classroom was around the corner from where it happened.
A warning just went out that there was an active threat on campus. Immediately, myself and my fellow classmates shut off the lights, barricaded the door, hid in our corners. Myself and many others, of course, started immediately texting our families, our friends.
President Trump met yesterday at the White House with Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, the first European leader to meet with Trump since he announced tariffs on most foreign products. Trump said he's 100% certain that he will be able to make a deal with her. NPR's Deepa Shivram has more on the story.
There's not really a sense of what the deal they're talking about will actually look like, the details of it. But, you know, as a reminder, after the initial tariffs were announced, Trump then put a 90-day pause on most of them. So where things stand right now is that all countries except China are facing a flat 10% tariff. China, meanwhile, is still sitting at a tariff of over 145%. And now Trump says that other countries want to make deals with the U.S., but he's also said that it's the U.S. that's going to set the deal.
This is NPR News in Washington. Senator Chris Van Hollen met yesterday with Kilmer Abrego-Garcia, a Maryland man who had been sent to prison in El Salvador illegally. The Maryland Democrat posted a picture on X of himself and Abrego-Garcia sitting at a table. The Trump administration has been ordered to facilitate his return. In Cincinnati, thousands of people are taking part in an annual Good Friday tradition. From member station WVXU, Tana Weingartner reports.
The tradition is known as praying the steps. People come from across the country to slowly ascend nearly 100 steps up a steep hill to Holy Cross Immaculata Catholic Church, stopping on each stair to say a prayer or meditate. Church member Larry Cochran says the practice dates to the late 1850s.
We invite all faiths, all denominations to come out and to pray on the steps or meditate. And then they're invited in the church at the top of the steps to light a candle or continue with their prayer or meditation.
The ritual began at midnight with the blessing of the steps. People climb and pray throughout the day. For NPR News, I'm Tana Weingartner in Cincinnati.
The Supreme Court will hear arguments next month on the legality of President Trump's executive order restricting birthright citizenship. Then most those born in the U.S. are American citizens. The court had ruled in favor of birthright citizenship 127 years ago. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. And from the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at CySimsFoundation.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Since the Trump administration took office, it has cut billions of dollars in global health programs. That's everything from vaccines to food assistance to treat malnutrition. Throughout all this, the administration has said that life-saving medications for people with HIV would, however, continue to flow. But on the ground, we're hearing a very different story. NPR's Gabriela Emanuel joins us. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Gabriella, you've just returned from Zambia to find out more about what's going on. Why'd you choose Zambia?
So I chose Zambia because, like many countries in Africa, it was very hard hit by the HIV/AIDS epidemic, which peaked in the mid-90s. And the U.S. has played a pivotal role in controlling the epidemic, including paying for HIV medication. This has been a bipartisan 20-plus year effort, and it's been very effective. New infections have dropped by almost 40% in the last 15 years. Life expectancy has rebounded. So I wanted to see if those HIV drugs are, as the administration says, still accessible.
And are they still accessible?
Well, a lot of people can no longer get their HIV meds, and now they're getting sick. For example, I went to one neighborhood in Zambia's Copper Belt. Just on the edge of town, there's a U.S.-funded HIV clinic next to a church. And the clinic, it's totally locked up.
Now it's closed.
Reverend Billiance Chondwe tells me that it was abruptly shut down in January when the U.S. issued a stop work order. He lets me peek in.
Did they take out the furniture? And they cut the electricity?
Yes.
Okay.
A few months ago, this clinic served thousands of HIV patients. Across the country, there are dozens and dozens of clinics like this one, U.S.-funded, now closed. I walk into the neighborhood and meet many of the clinic's former patients. One is 42-year-old Mary Mayongana. Mary is tall but incredibly skinny. And when I first meet her, she's at home, sitting on the cement floor, her head resting against the brick wall. In the 2.5 months since the clinic shut, she hasn't been able to find a steady supply of her daily HIV meds.
So there are times when I'll go 2 weeks without taking my medication.
Sometimes neighbors give her a few HIV pills. Mary tries to stretch the supply.
So I'll skip 2 days and then take a tablet, skip 2 days and take a tablet.
It's a risky approach since it breeds drug-resistant HIV, but Mary says it's all she can think to do. Without her meds, she's developed classic signs of the virus coming back: weakness, fatigue, fevers, sweats, and a terrible itchy rash.
My skin on my arms is peeling. I've got open wounds. I've got an open wound on my leg.
She's heard there are still HIV drugs at Zambian government clinics, but the closest one is a 45-minute walk, and Mary struggles to even stand.
I spend a lot of time thinking about what is likely to become of me.
Mary is far from alone. Oswell Sindaza oversees a free HIV clinic. He used to have a staff of 21, but after the U.S. cut foreign aid, they were all laid off.
We have over 6,400 clients, and I'm just alone.
6,000 patients for one doctor?
Yes.
And these are all HIV-positive patients?
These are HIV-positive clients. So the clinics are really overwhelmed. I'm moving like a headless chicken.
He says he knows a lot of HIV patients are without their meds, and the virus is rebounding.
Wow, Gabriella, I mean, I'm listening to that, and clearly these life-saving medications are not getting to where they need to be. And the Trump administration is saying they continue. So where's the disconnect here?
So the HIV meds are part of this broader system, a complex supply chain and distribution method. And when the U.S. started pulling contracts and shutting down funding, that whole system just collapsed in a lot of places. And I should note, the U.S. State Department did not respond to my request for comment.
So then who fills the gap here? Does it now fall to the country's Ministry of Health?
Yes, in many cases it does. And I reached out to the Zambian Ministry of Health and they declined to discuss the U.S. aid cuts with me. But in the country, there is this recognition that they were too dependent on aid. Yet at the same time, there is also a lot of outrage that this shutdown happened with absolutely no warning.
NPR's Gabriella Emanuel. Thank you, Gabriella.
Thank you.
The Trump administration is shutting down an offshore wind project that was under construction near Long Island. The multi-billion-dollar project would have supplied more than 500,000 homes with power. Here's NPR's Julia Simon.
The project is called Empire Wind One, and this week, Interior Secretary Doug Burgum sent a memo calling for a halt to the project. Yesterday, Equinor, which operates the project, announced it's suspending all construction. Donald Trump is a longtime critic of wind energy. One of his first actions back in the White House was to issue a moratorium halting new offshore wind projects. But this action, halting a project that already had permits and already broke ground, is an escalation, says Robert Freudenberg at the New York Energy Nonprofit Regional Plan Association.
Yeah, I'd say this really is next level offshore wind aggression.
In his memo to the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, or BOEM, Burgum wrote that the project's approval was, quote, rushed through by the Biden administration. But there's no evidence to suggest it was rushed, says Matthew Eisenson at Columbia University.
BOEM spent 2.5 years conducting an environmental review. The final product of that environmental review is over 3,000 pages long, and it's very thorough. Now, this rationale is very suspect.
The Department of Interior did not respond to NPR's request for comment. Trump has often said, without evidence, that the offshore wind industry kills whales. On Monday, the Government Accountability Office issued a report investigating offshore wind. It finds that the offshore wind industry poses little risk to whales. About 10% of U.S. energy comes from wind. That number was slated to grow with new offshore wind projects in states like Massachusetts and Virginia. But Freudenberg says those projects could be at risk, as are other projects that already have federal permitting.
It should send alarm bells, not just to the offshore wind industry, but to industries beyond offshore wind, that the federal government could choose to stop projects that had been approved and are underway at their whim.
He says now any industry that requires federal permits should wonder, will the U.S. federal government be true to its word? Julia Simon, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Director Joe Wright joins us to talk about the 20th anniversary of his film adaptation of the Jane Austen classic, Pride and Prejudice, next time on Here and Now.
The NPR app cuts through the noise, bringing you local, national, and global coverage. No paywalls, no profits, no nonsense. Download it in your app store today.
Good morning, I'm Amy Martinez. You might think you've watched Star Wars, but unless you were in the theaters in the 1970s, you probably haven't seen the real original. You know, the one where Han beat Greedo to the punch. George Lucas released updated editions for decades and blocked screenings of that first release, but that version is getting screened for the first time since 1978 at a British film festival in June, before the print goes back into carbonite. Cold storage. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez. This weekend, wrestling fans will be watching for the dark side of John Cena. Sure, he's played a good guy in the ring for more than two decades. However, now in what he says is his final year in competition, he has turned bad.
Come on, enough already. Somebody stop this. John, what are you doing?
Yeah, John, what are you doing? Now, that was last month at WWE's Elimination Chamber, where Cena took part in a beatdown of world champion Cody Rhodes. On Sunday, they meet again, with Cena challenging Rhodes for the title at WrestleMania in Las Vegas. And that is where we find David Shoemaker, author and co-host of the Ringer's wrestling podcast, The Masked Man Show. So, David, I mean, the wrestling world has a word for this, the heel turn. So how big of a deal was it when John Cena did it?
It was a really big deal. One, because John Cena, like you said, hadn't been a heel for the 20 years of his fame. He's just been known as the most consistent babyface, as they say in the business. It was also a big deal from a fan's perspective because we've been begging for him to turn heel for most of those 20 years. You know, we're used to seeing our wrestlers go back and forth on the spectrum. And John Cena had just been a stalwart, refusing to embrace the dark side for this whole time.
Now, on WWE Raw last month, Cena sounded like he kind of enjoys playing the bad guy. So let's take a listen to that.
I am going to ruin wrestling for every fan, for every wrestler, for everyone.
Why would he want to go out like this? I mean, is this something that fans actually like? I mean, you said you've been clamoring for it, but does everyone else feel that way?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I talk to wrestlers all the time. Most of them prefer playing heel, right? I mean, it's more fun. You get to just ham it up out there for the fans. Also, you know, they all know that boos are just as good as cheers in their line of work. Will he go out as a heel? This is his final year. My guess is that his last month will probably be as a fan favorite because you can always go home again. But for right now, he's getting to do the thing that he's always wanted to do too. I mean, it's not just the fans. He's talked openly about wanting this opportunity, wanting to play the bad guy. And I think you can tell from his monologues in the ring, he's really enjoying it.
Now, last month, there was another star of the big screen in the ring coaxing Cena to go over to the dark side, and that was The Rock. So, I mean, what does it mean that these two mega movie stars are playing wrestling villains? I mean, is he following The Rock's footsteps here?
He is in a lot of ways. I mean, The Rock came back last year and teased a WrestleMania main event match, and he was a hero, and he thought everybody would get behind him. But after he took the spot from Cody Rhodes, the fans turned and said, no, we don't want that. We want Cody. He's the guy that we've been following all this time. And The Rock played it on the fly and turned heel. And it turned out to be the best move he could make. I think there was a lot of conventional wisdom that a Hollywood star the level of The Rock couldn't play a heel because it would jeopardize his mainstream appeal. It would make those rope line interviews awkward or whatever. But it turned out to be the best business decision he could have made. He's more famous now and than he possibly could have been, and everybody just took it in stride. And I think you're seeing the same thing with John Cena.
Do you think he's really going to retire?
Well, pro wrestlers are really bad at retiring, famously, just like boxers, you know? I mean, you usually retire at the end of a match when everybody's watching you because you want that moment in the sun, right? And then 2 months later, you're sitting at home and you don't have anything to do and you change your mind. But of all the wrestlers that have ever said they're going to retire, John Cena is one that I believe. He's a man of, it seems to be, of real conviction outside of the ring and would not be doing this without having really thought it through.
David Shoemaker, he hosts the wrestling podcast, The Masked Man Show. He's also author of The Squared Circle, Life, Death, and Professional Wrestling. David, thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. Every president brings a personal touch to the Oval Office. Ronald Reagan brought a collection of bronze saddles and his jar of Jelly Bellies. Barack Obama introduced a bust of Martin Luther King Jr. and a bowl of apples. Donald Trump, in his second term, is bringing gold, a lot of it. So how is that changing the look and feel of the White House and the image the presidency projects? Our colleague Michelle Martin posed that question to Robin Givhan. She's a senior critic at large at The Washington Post who recently wrote about what she calls the gilding of the Oval Office.
Well, I think one of the things that most people who've seen pictures of the Oval Office might recall is that over the fireplace mantle, there has long been this large planter filled with ivy. And, you know, the story of that ivy goes back many, many, many presidencies. And that ivy has now been replaced by a series of gold objects. And the pieces that are actually on the mantle are typically used for displaying large floral arrangements, for holding desserts and tea cakes and bonbons. So they're not necessarily things that you would naturally see in an office. And they have been part of the White House collection for years.
So I take it you're not a fan.
I would say that it looks a bit cluttered. And when these pieces were first acquired by the White House, there was some concern in Congress that they reflected too much of an appreciation and an ode to the monarchy, which was not at all what the United States was about. And they also reflect an idea about wealth and power and privilege that feels very of a piece with a different time.
You know, this is always a thing, like, what is taste, right? And a lot of people would sort of say, well, taste is sort of ascribing something to being tasteful or not tasteful is inherently classist. What would you say to that?
I think that's very true. And I think that to some degree, there is an elitist point of view that would look at that, the way that he's decorated the Oval Office, and say that it looks very nouveau riche. And then there are those who could also look at it and say that it's, you know, simply an exuberant celebration of success. But I think one thing that is unnerving is so much of it seems to be situated around this idea of regalness. That is a real departure from the kind of power that the Oval Office has always projected. Part of its power, I think, has come from the fact that it didn't need all of these elements in order to convey authority, that the authority came from this idea of the people and of democracy.
Robin Givhan is Washington Post senior critic at large. Robin, thank you.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
For Easter, churches in Appalachia sell handmade chocolate eggs as fundraisers. Some churches have become famous for the treats. Reporter Zach Harrell takes us into one of their kitchens.
When Pastor John Langenstein found out 4 years ago he'd been assigned to a new church in Clarksburg, West Virginia, everyone he talked to had the same response.
Oh, you're going to the egg church. Didn't matter who I was talking to. Oh, you're going to the egg church. And I said, okay, well, that'll be interesting. And then, oh, you're not ready.
And he wasn't ready for the major chocolate egg operation at Northview United Methodist Church. Every spring, church members gather in the basement kitchen to crank out shiny chocolate eggs.
The molds are double-coated. Yep, and ready to go. We'll put filling in them. And we're doing maple nut this morning.
Serena Ashcraft is in charge today. I asked her how many eggs they usually make for Easter.
Oh my gosh, Nadine, how many do we make?
Oh, between 6,000 and 8,000.
Yeah.
That's Nadine Holt with her in the kitchen. She's in charge of mixing the fillings for those 6,000 to 8,000 eggs.
She's 84 years old.
87!
87? Oh my gosh, that even makes it more awesome.
Holt has been volunteering since the very first egg sale at Northview in 1997.
The people are dead now that I started with, and they just said, we're going to do Easter eggs. They need you want to help? And I says, sure, here I am.
Northview's eggs come in six flavors: coconut, cherry nut, maple nut, peanut butter, butterfinger, and solid chocolate.
These are the same recipes we've been using for 26 years.
Pastor Langenstein says they make eggs 3 days a week starting in January, all with volunteer labor from the congregation of about 100 people. They spread melted chocolate into molds, add the filling, and box up the finished eggs for sale.
All generations coming in. Last year, our youngest person helping out with eggs was 6 years old, and our oldest was, I think you win that, Nadine, 87. But.
Northview eggs sell for $3 to $9 a piece, depending on the size. They're a big fundraiser for the church and an Eastertime delicacy in these parts. They rarely give them away. Even broken eggs sell for half price. But in the name of journalism, they let me have a taste.
Here's a Butterfinger. It tastes like a Butterfinger.
I told you.
It's peanut butter and candy corn.
Yeah.
The origin of the church-made chocolate Easter egg is kind of hazy. They appear to have first shown up in the mid-20th century in central Pennsylvania before spreading through the rest of central Appalachia. There are other churches all through West Virginia that make and sell chocolate Easter eggs, but Northview is the best known.
To my knowledge, we are the biggest. If there is a bigger, they're not advertising as well as we are.
They sell their eggs around town at beauty parlors, car dealerships, tire shops, and even the courthouse. They also ship them across the country. But for volunteers, it's less about the money.
Other than the fact that, you know, obviously it helps support the work of the church. Is it just fun? For as much work as it is and as much as a taskmaster Serena can be, we get, you know.
We laugh, we joke.
For this small congregation, community and fellowship is worth the long days on the Easter egg production line. For NPR News, I'm Zach Harold in Clarksburg, West Virginia.
You can learn more about how the Northview Easter eggs are made on the podcast, The Daily Yonder. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Layla Faldin.
The moon and its light, I walked on the clouds above.